getting more and more microphones every day. Not tonight. Okay, first of all, can you hear at the back? We head up. Can you hear? Okay. If during the talk, because I like to move away from the microphone every now and again, if you find that you can't hear, please make some gesticulation so that I can find out that you're not hearing. The continuing on this series of talks and the meditation retreat, this evening we're coming to a very fascinating part of meditation. We're talking about what we call the nimittas. These nimittas are these wonderful lights which appear in the mind at a certain stage in the meditation. It's an important thing to discuss because this happens. It's part of the nature of a mind which gets more and more still. And it's important that we understand exactly what they are, how to make use of them, to know the dangers, so that we can employ them to go even deeper into the meditation, so that we can understand a huge amount of insight and get a great deal of peace and stillness. To understand what these nimittas are, I want to go back to the nature of the body and the mind, and the way that the Buddha described this thing we call you, in terms of the six senses. You know those six senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind being the sixth sense. It is quite fascinating that in Buddhism, actually in all Eastern philosophy, we've always had those six senses from the very beginning. However, these days, that if anyone talks about the sixth sense, they think you're talking about a movie. Because in the West, is only supposed to have five senses. However, having studied a little bit of philosophy and knowing my history, I know that even in the ancient philosophies of the West, the philosophies which were originating, they said they originated in Greece, in ancient Greece, even though that, fascinating, many of those Greek philosophers say they got all of their knowledge from the Indians. In other words, from the Buddhists. But nevertheless, even people like Aristotle said there were six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, physical touch, and the last being the mind, just like in Buddhism. And interestingly, he called it the common sense. Just like the Buddha said that the mind has its own objects, but it could also take every other object of the other five senses. The mind is common to all. And that's why Aristotle called it the common sense. And so I make this joke these days, that somehow Western culture, number one, it lost its mind, and it also at the same time lost its common sense, which is one of the reasons why Western culture is sometimes so crazy. It lost its mind and also lost its common sense. But Buddhism always has had this mind from the very beginning. And it's an important part of understanding that this mind is completely independent of the body. To actually find out what this mind is one of the functions of this meditation. In order to understand what the nimittas are, I go back to this ancient Buddhist classification of the six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind, knowing. For most people, the external five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching is usually so dominant, it takes up so much of our attention that we hardly ever get to see and really understand this thing called the mind. Most of the time we are spending all of our energies and attention either seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting or physical touch. And what part of the mind we do experience is just what the mind takes up from those five fields, those five senses. It never really is a pure mind with its own objects. Now what happens in meditation? we are literally suppressing the five external senses. You're closing your eyes so you can't see anything. After a while, you try and sit in a meditation situation, a hall or a house or a room. It doesn't have to be absolutely silent, as long as that the sounds aren't changing too much. There's a constant hum is enough, because after a while you'd be meditating and the sense of hearing just disappears. You just can't hear anything, what's happening outside. Sometimes if it's the sound of the rain, you just don't hear it. If it's the sound of the traffic, you just can't hear it, because the mind is no longer paying attention. The sense of sound, of hearing, turns off. Smell and taste is very easy to turn off, because smelling and tasting is not, for a mature person, a dominant sense. But the last of the senses, physical touch, is one of the hardest for you to turn off. But if you sit still and you let go, after a while you can't feel the body at all. You can't feel your hands or your legs or your body. You don't know where it is. When these things happen, you can say that the five senses have completely disappeared for you. For many of you, the way we allow these five senses to disappear, instead of just letting go of the body all in one go, we use like a halfway house by watching the breath. The feeling of the breath, which many people focus on, is a feeling in the body. You know the breath because it's a physical touch somewhere in your body. And we use the breath meditation to say, okay, we won't let go of all the five senses in one hit. We'll just watch the breath first of all and let all the other senses disappear. Let all of the sounds, sights, smells and tastes disappear, as well as all the other feelings except for the breath. So it's just the last piece of physical touch, which we just keep on the breath first of all. But that's only for the time being, because eventually we want to let go of the breath as well, until the breath completely disappears. Now, how that happens, many of you have experienced already. Now, first of all, as I've said many times, you have to have enough silence and present moment awareness to be able to do this job properly. If you're not focused in the moment, you're looking in the wrong place, if there's too much inner commentary, that is like a sound, an internal sound. Still, you won't be able to turn off the physical sound. So you have to develop a bit of silence. You have to develop present moment awareness. And then you start to watch the breath. When people start watching the breath in their meditation, first of all, as I've said many times in the interviews and up here, it does not matter where you watch the breath. It doesn't have to be in the tip of the nose, it doesn't have to be in the abdomen, because after a while the whole body will disappear anyway. I was fortunate in the way in which I learned how to watch the breath. I didn't watch my breath at any part of the body. I just simply asked myself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? How do I know? And I knew the breath. I could tell whether the breath was going in or whether it was going out by a physical feeling which I didn't care to locate anywhere on the body. I just knew, that was all. And because I never located it on the body, that was to my advantage, because it meant the body could disappear even more quickly than usual. I just knew the breath, that's all. It was a physical touch. I didn't know where. To be able to calm down the physical touch so that sense completely subdued and disappears, you have to calm it down, calm, calm, calm. And the trick with calming down the body is not to interfere with it. If you go interfering with it, you literally stir up the feelings in the body and you get more. A good example of that, which somebody asked in the interviews, they say, if I have an itch on the body, should I scratch it? You try that. If you scratch one itch, there'll be another one waiting in line to be scratched afterwards. And there'll be itch after itch after itch. This is what happens with the body. Once it realizes you're going to pay attention to it, it will actually keep on calling again and again and again. Sometimes I give it the simile of not answering the telephone. This simile goes like this. It's sitting meditation, it's nice and quiet, and you get a telephone call. It's your knee ringing up, I'm aching, move me. If you answer the call from your knee, and you move that, then there'll be another phone call coming in a short while later. Now this is my ear, scratch me. Now this is my foot, now I'm squashed, move me. There'll be no end of calls, which is just like in your office. Once they know you're in, at the office, they will keep on calling. But if you refuse to answer the phone, just let it ring, then somehow the word gets around, you're not in, you're not answering calls today, which means no one rings. If you stop scratching the body, moving this, moving that, after a short while, it's like everybody in the body, all the little parts of the body, realize, no, you're not in today, you're not going to answer any calls, and so the body just disappears. It's an amazing, wonderful way of getting tranquility of the body, just by leaving it alone, not bothering about it. Obviously, if you have intense feelings, great pain, then you should move. But if it's just a small irritation, leave them alone. I had to learn this, how to let go of the body, by just not bothering about it. In the first years in northeast Thailand, when I say that there was heaps of mosquitoes in those forests, there were huge numbers of mosquitoes. And we'd never had any protection at all in that first year. There was no mosquito repellent to rub on your body, there was no mosquito coils, there was no mosquito netting, nothing. And worse, my teacher Ajahn Chah insisted on everybody meditating outside under the trees at dusk. Just when the mosquitoes came out, we came out to join them. It was just as if saying, like, eat me, come on. And worse than that, it was all right for Ajahn Chah and the Thai monks, because they didn't tend to get eaten by the mosquitoes so much. Because you actually could see afterwards that, you know, your arm was full of bumps because of the mosquitoes have bitten you. Look at the Thais, there's hardly anything there at all. It took me a long time to figure out why did these mosquitoes always choose the Western monks. And now I know why. It's because, just like you, that when Western food comes here for the first time to Ipoh, everybody wants to try it. And that's what was happening with these mosquitoes. It's the first time in generations they had Western food. So the word went around, this is strange, this is weird, come and have some Western food today. So they chose us rather than the Thais. They could always get Thai food any day. And so we were covered with these mosquitoes, and this is again not an exaggeration, with a monk who was the same years as me, we used to sit next to each other, he was an American monk. We decided to play a game, to count the mosquitoes on your arm when you were meditating, to see who got the most. What we found, you get to about 40 or 50 on your arm at the same time, and then you couldn't count them anymore. They were just too close together. You couldn't resolve one mosquito from the next. There's so many on your arm at once. And if you listen carefully, you could actually hear the blood draining from your arm. Slurp, slurp. But that was an exaggeration. I couldn't hear anything. But it's extremely irritating. And many times, now you'd want to spot those mosquitoes, but you can't. You're a monk. And your teacher, Ajahn Chah, is, you know, just a couple of feet away. So you couldn't do that. Ugh. So next you think you want to run away. They had all the Thai disciples were in front of you as well. You'd open your eyes, get ready to run. But they were all sitting there. It was really unfair and tortured. So the only way you could deal with that is to let go of the body. Just don't care about it anymore. Don't even, if you try and scratch any of those itches. Well, what I did the first is absolute stupidity. Sometimes a mosquito would land on your arm and you just try to nudge it away. And of course it wouldn't go anywhere, it would just go up a couple of inches and land somewhere else and give you another bite. So it's better just to let it bite you and you only have one each rather than two. But yet, sometimes you had so much kindness and metta. You see this little mosquito, go on, have something to eat. You know, because you're a monk, you have better loving kindness. Go on, eat something. And so you look at that mosquito. It started off, you did have kindness, compassion towards it. Go on, have something. It's only a small bit of pain, but for you, it's your whole dinner and your life. May you, mosquito, be happy and well. And you know what this mosquito would do? It would actually put its nose in one part of your skin. And it would draw out a little bit of blood. It wouldn't like that. And it would walk over a couple of steps and do it again. And it kept on doing that three or four times. And it was taking advantage of my loving kindness. It was unfair, stupid mosquito. And you give them an inch and they take a mile, as they say. So, the only way you could really deal with that problem is just to forget about the body. And instead you just watch the breath. And because I only had one alternative to watching the breath, and that was just being aware of the incredible irritation of the mosquitoes. So there's no choice, basically. You had to watch the breath. You couldn't wander away anywhere. You couldn't go off into dreams or fantasies or thinking. If you lost the awareness of the breath for one moment, you're back on the irritating arm. So actually they taught me how just to really watch the breath without letting it go. So what was actually happening, that all my attention was on just one part of the physical touch, which was the breathing, and I couldn't feel anything else in my body. And then eventually, because you were just watching just one part, eventually that one part disappeared. So you didn't even notice the breath anymore. You were off in this deep meditation, which was beautiful. And the strange thing, when you came out after deep meditation like that, you actually found there was no bumps on your skin at all. It was as if the mosquitoes hadn't bitten you. At first, I thought that was some sort of psychic phenomena. You get into deep meditation, you have some sort of force field around you that the mosquitoes don't bite. But about two or three years ago, I found out a scientific explanation. And actually, mosquitoes, they're attracted to the carbon dioxide which comes out of your pores. So the higher your metabolism, actually, the more you're worrying and thinking and doing something, the less rested you are, the more your metabolism goes up, the more carbon dioxide comes out, the more the mosquitoes know you're there. The more you're worried, the more you're a sitting target. But when you really calm down, and when you get into deep meditation, your metabolism goes down so much, you're hardly breathing at all. Sometimes your breathing stops. But more than that, just everything just calms down so slow, you hardly metabolize at all. So I realized that in those deep meditations, because the mind was so still and the body was so still, you weren't giving out any carbon dioxide at all. You were literally becoming invisible to the mosquitoes. Interesting, a little bit of science about why when you go into deep meditation, the mosquitoes can't find you. But anyway, the point was, it was a way of letting go of the body as well as the other four senses. So a lot of time we have to focus on one part of the body. If you're very lucky, you can actually let go of the body all in one go. If you've got skill in meditation, you can go straight from the silence and present moment awareness. You can actually bypass the breath and go straight to the mind, the sixth sense, which you will know as a nimitta coming up in the mind. However, for most people, that's just going too fast. When you take shortcuts, you usually get lost. So it's much better to do the age-old path of, first of all, watching your breath. In order to allow this body to slow down, you can't interfere with the breath. You've got to leave it alone. So the first thing when you start watching the breath, if it's not your natural breath, by natural breath, as if you weren't watching it, that's what it would be like. Because you're breathing now quite naturally, quite easily, but as soon as people start watching the breath, then it gets uncomfortable. And why is that? Simply because we are in the habit of whatever we observe, we interfere with. It's just like mothers-in-law, as soon as they see their son-in-law, they interfere. They can't leave anything alone. It's just like backseat drivers They always say, don't go this way, go that way, go quicker, go slow. They always interfere. Like even some of you. You know, you're not part of the management of this retreat. You probably already interfere, telling Judy, next time do it this way, don't do it that way. Can't we just leave things alone and just allow it to be? The thing is that it's our nature, our ego, ourself. Whatever we see, whatever we look at, whatever we feel, we always want to control. We interfere with it. So here, when you're watching your breath, you've got to develop the ability to be able to observe something without criticizing it, without controlling it, leaving it completely alone, allowing it to be exactly as it is, and you just know it and accept it for what it is. You watch without interfering. It's a hard thing to do. You might go to somebody's house. When you go in their house, straight away you assess it. Sometimes you criticize them for their choice of color on the curtains or whatever it is. We are far, far too critical. And because of that habit, whenever we just watch the breath, straight away the breath becomes uncomfortable because we interfere with it. If you can be able to watch your breath and it's just a normal breath, as if you weren't watching it at all, then you know how to watch with letting go. It's exactly the same as some of these wildlife photographers. You know, they have to crawl in the bush to be able to take photographs of these animals. If the animals know that someone is looking, they won't be natural anymore. They start to play up to the cameras. But if you take a natural shot, it means they don't know you're watching and they're exactly as they would be if you weren't there. It's the same with the breath. Be able to observe the breath as it didn't know you were watching. And if you can do that, the breath slows down. Because it slows down, it becomes very calm and very, very peaceful. After a while, you start to refine the breath. The whole experience of the physical sensation of the breath fills the mind. And this is that stage where you've got full awareness of the breath. From the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. From the very beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath, you see the whole of the breath. It's an important stage. So you know from the very beginning, this is where the breath starts. And you can see the sensations change and grow as it gets to its peak and then declines as the in-breath fades away. And then the out-breath starts, grows and then fades away until it's finished. That's the degree of mindfulness you need. As you're watching that breath from beginning to end, beginning to end, the next stage of the meditation is where you get so focused you actually can't tell whether it's the beginning or an end, the in-breath or an out-breath. The simile which is given in the Visuddhimagga by Buddha Gosa is the best simile, because many of you might remember this. This is a simile of a carpenter who's sawing a piece of wood. When you start sawing a piece of wood, you can see the whole saw from the handle to the tip, and a lot of the wood as well. But when you focus, you've got to focus on where the saw is hitting the wood, so you're sawing in the correct place. After a while, when you focus, you can't see the end of the saw, you can't see the handle. All you can actually see is one or two teeth of the saw, just in the area where it's touching the wood. So you can't know whether it's the beginning or the end of the saw. Well, when you focus, all you know is breath. And you don't know whether it's in or out, beginning or end. What's actually happening, the feeling of touch is getting so refined, it's almost disappearing. When that happens, do not think, oh, I've lost the breath. It is the breath you're watching, but you're watching it in a more refined way. The physical sensation of touch is almost disappearing. At this particular stage, you should be getting some happiness coming up. The stillness of the mind brings energy to mindfulness. The energy of the mindfulness is experienced as happiness and joy, beauty. As I said a couple of days ago, when you start getting powerful mindfulness, everything starts to grow, the food starts to taste delicious, everything is just happy. So the breath at this stage has to start to appear happy. It becomes a happy feeling. This is again important, because that happiness is a sign that the mind is becoming strengthened and powered. And so actually, to explain what happens next, you can actually watch my hands here, because it's the only way, not having a blackboard or a whiteboard, I just use my hands here. This represents the five senses in my left hand. My right hand represents the mind. Because for most of us, our mind is not powerful at all. The five senses are so much stronger than the mind. Their amplitude is so much stronger, it just swamps any information about the mind. Because you're calming the senses down, at the same time giving more power, more strength to the mind, there comes a stage in the meditation where they're about the same strength. When the mind and those five senses are about the same strength, by empowering the mind and by subduing the five senses, that's when you start to glimpse the mind. The mind is perceived in nearly all cases as a light which appears inside the mind. In the stage of the beautiful breath, sometimes the breath disappears and you've got this beautiful light comes up in the mind. It's called a nimitta. What that light is, it's not something you see with your eyes. Your eyes are closed. It is actually seen with the mind. It's the way the mind experiences itself. It's very common when people first start to see that nimitta, that light in the mind. They think they must be facing a window and the sun is coming through. So even today someone said they turned around just to make sure they weren't seeing any sunlight. It was actually really the nimitta. And it always is. It's not the sunlight coming through. Sometimes it happens. I'm sitting in here meditating and there's a sudden flash. However, that's somebody taking a photograph of me. It's not the nimitta. Because I know when nimittas come up, when they don't. But it's similar to the flash, but only something which lasts a long time. But of course, when the mind is experienced, because the five senses are still, you know, pretty strong, and the mind is only just about coming level, sometimes it just flashes up for a short while and just disappears again. You cannot maintain it. So don't be concerned about that. That's a good sign, but keep on subduing those five senses by just keeping awareness on the beautiful breath. Be still and forget about those nimittas when they first come up. However, because I talk about these nimittas, and I have to talk about these nimittas, people say, oh, I want. Especially if I say already a couple of people have experienced those nimittas, and all of you haven't experienced those nimittas yet. Why them, not me? I want to get these nimittas, come on. And you get too much desire, too much craving. Be careful, the way I teach meditation, that's a danger. Because it's all these amazing things which I say is going to happen to you, and you want them. If you want them, they will never come. So don't be careful of that big hindrance of desire, what I said last night, and wanting. Just be content, be patient, don't want anything, just be silent, be still, and these things will come to you. The more you chase after them, the less likelihood you will experience them. It's an important point. So just very patient, just keep on watching the breath. And just become so beautiful, so still. And then when a nimitta comes up, it comes up and it stays. There's two important things about these nimittas. One is, well, let's call it three things. One is its simplicity. Number two is its stability. Number three is its beauty, its power. Its simplicity, stability, and its power. The simplicity of the nimitta is explained by this. Sometimes people, when the first nimitta comes up, they see many, many different colours, all moving all over the place, and sometimes it turns into a scene where they're seeing a forest or a lake, or it's beautiful meadows, or they see demons, they see angels, or whatever. Yeah, it's fun, but it shows your mind is too complicated. Keep it simple. But nevertheless, when this thing happens and you see this beautiful scenery and mountains, you might even see monks or demons or whatever, most people, most teachers say, leave it alone. I say, no, indulge in it. You've worked so hard, okay, it's not really useful at all, but you get a bit of a payoff, you got a bit of reward, because the meditation retreat can be so boring. Now something is happening, sort of indulge in it for a few minutes. It's like going off to see a movie during the middle of the meditation retreat. It's what I call meditation special effects. So it's happening, and actually there's no danger to it as long as you don't get into it and believe it's anything important. No matter what you see, don't think it's important. Don't think that these are demons or angels speaking to you. If they give you a number, don't go out and buy a lottery ticket. You'll lose a lot of money. Because it's not real. At this particular stage, you can't trust it. It's just like the mind playing around. It's like, you know, if you've got a child, and you know, your son, for example, and he's been at school, he's been at home, and say you send him to London to go to university, and you can expect this is the first time he's been away from home. He's going to play around a bit in London the first few days. It's nature. It's the same with the mind. As soon as the mind is free from these five senses, it's going to play around a bit. It's got this freedom. It can make all these amazing things and enjoy itself. But those diverse nimitters, you know, they're complex nimitters. They don't get anywhere with those things. You can play around there for a while, then just go back to the breath afterwards. Your mind wasn't stable and simple enough. However, you can play around. Don't take it seriously. It is as real as imagination is real. I mentioned this to someone today. Imagination and reality at this particular stage are the same. The mind is the forerunner of all things. It is the creator. So this is as real as anything else in your life. However, don't need to be afraid of anything. If you ever get scared, you can do what I did when I started getting these complex nimitters the first time. Most of them were really nice, but one day I was meditating and I got this image and this nimitter stage of this demon, this devil, and my goodness, he looked frightening. He had these huge eyes almost falling out of the eye sockets, and there were blood red on the outside. His mouth had his fangs sharp, you know, like a shark's jaws, and they were dripping with blood. And he had around his neck, had this skull drooped around his neck. And he looked so frightening, his hair was like a pug, all spikes. And I recognized it straight away. What I'd seen in the temples, you know, you see these demons in the temples. But I had enough wisdom at that time. I didn't get scared at all, even though they would go, the mouth was hanging out like demons usually do. Because I knew it was like a creation of the mind, and I knew because my mind created it, it could also keep on creating it. So, just like I used to do when I was at school, I started doing some doodling on that picture. I blacked out some of its fangs. So it had this mouth which really needed to go to a dentist, had all these cavities in there. And I did this. And instead of its side of its mouth turned down, really fearsome, I just, by an act of will, just very easily, just turned the corners of his mouth up. So this demon was grinning at me with his toothless smile. And because it had his big bulging eyes, I put a pair of sunglasses on it. And to finish off, I put this straw hat with a little flower coming out of its on its head. And so this demon, which was a few seconds earlier absolutely terrified, now was a joke. And actually in my mind I laughed, and then the demon vanished and never came back again. I completely humiliated it. And that's the way to deal with demons, humiliate them. So the point was, I was playing with the complex nimitters. You can do that if you like. You're in complete control, so don't be afraid. Play around if you really want to. It's a bit of fun, in the meditation. You don't get anywhere. It's a waste of time, really, but it's just a bit of encouragement for you that something's happening. But usually the complex limiters aren't useful. So usually you just push them aside. However, that if you really think that maybe you can make use of them, the only real way of making use of them is find out the most beautiful parts of that complex limiter. If it's a tree, the most beautiful tree, the most beautiful leaf on that tree, the most beautiful part of that leaf. Keep sort of focusing on the most beautiful part. And as you're doing it, you're simplifying. And you'll find that way that sometimes, say you just focus on the leaf, the most beautiful part of the leaf, the greenest part of the leaf, that might turn into a limiter, a simple one, which I'm going to describe a bit later. So that's the first thing, try and keep it simple. The other one is the stability of the limiter, because sometimes it keeps coming and going. It's never going to be useful for you, it's just like too frustrating. You want to somehow find a limiter which doesn't change, which stays there. And the reason why the limiter keeps on moving is because you are always moving. When I understood what this limiter was, it is a reflection of your mind, of the sixth sense. The sixth sense is seeing itself. It is like you're looking at yourself in a mirror. But this is the mind looking itself in a mirror. Now if you can imagine that, you're in the bathroom looking yourself in a mirror. And the image in the mirror is moving backwards and forwards. Is it the mirror's fault? If you just held the mirror still, is that going to stop the image moving backwards and forwards? Of course not. And that's usually what people try and do. They try and hold the mirror still when the limiter is moving. And nothing happens, it just keeps on moving. I realize that using the simile of a mirror, if I'm looking and I see the image of me in the mirror moving backwards and forwards, it's because the one who is watching is moving. It's the watcher causes the limiter to move. So from that insight, I realize that I just have to keep still, to keep more still. The one which was watching had to stop moving. When the one which was watching stopped moving, then my limiter stopped moving. And I realized how to stabilize the limiter. You need to have more stillness. At every stage of this meditation, you need to develop more stillness, less interference. The first stage, it's like the test you have in school, in university. The first year you're tested so much. Next year it's a harder test. You have to be more skillful. The third year, even more skill is expected of you. And every stage of meditation is like another test. Just to watch the breath, it takes a lot of mindfulness, a lot of letting go, a lot of stillness. To watch the beautiful breath, it's a harder task. You have to be more still, let go more. To be able to watch a limiter, you have to be incredibly still. And you have to just not interfere at all. When you interfere, you move. And the whole thing starts to tremble. So you have to be absolutely still. The best way of describing that stillness is in the classic story from my teacher Ajahn Chah of the still forest pool. That became a title to one of the books of many stories of his, of which that was one. However, that particular translation done by Paul Brighton didn't really go into the full detail of what that simile truly was. It was a simile especially for this stage of meditation. And the simile goes like this. You've heard, many of you have heard it before, but it bears repeating. It's a very powerful and helpful simile. In Thailand, in the time of Ajahn Chah, and even in the first years of when I was a monk, it was our tradition to go wandering after 5 years in one monastery. We'd wander from place to place in the jungles, going to visit other great teachers, or just seeking solitude, nice places to meditate. But when you were wandering in the jungle, you'd always aim to find a lake or a river sometime in the mid-afternoon, before it got dark. because for practical purposes you had to get some water to drink and you'd need a bath. Just walking all day through the jungle, you get very dirty and sweaty. And also maybe to wash some robes. So you'd always find a lake or a river about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or you'd look for one. And then you'd bathe, wash your robe, fill your water bottle, and then you'd move always away from the edge of the lake, maybe 20 meters or so. And there you put up your mosquito net and umbrella, and then you meditate all night there. And Ajahn Chah, in this beautiful simile, said that some evenings, instead of meditating, he just watched the animals come out to drink and bathe. Because at dusk, the animals would also come out. They also needed to drink and get some water for bathing. And they'd also play. But those animals, even in the tigers, they were so more afraid of human beings than human beings were afraid of them. More tigers get killed by humans than humans by tigers. So if those animals saw there was a human being around, they wouldn't come out. They maybe come out, see someone watching, then run away again. They'd rather be thirsty than be dead. So the only way he would be able to observe those animals is when he sat absolutely still. So the animals wouldn't know that anyone was watching. And they'd come out to play and drink, and he said it was delightful watching animals in nature playing around as if there was no one watching them. He said sometimes he was so still after the ordinary animals came out to play. He said sometimes some strange and amazing animals came out of the jungle. Animals which were so beautiful to see. Animals whose names he didn't know. His teachers, his parents hadn't told him that such animals exist. They were wonderful and so beautiful. But they would only come out when he was absolutely still. These were the shyest of all jungle animals. And if he even moved an eyebrow or said, "Wow," those animals would hear and they'd run away and wouldn't come out again for months. It was only when he was absolutely still would they come out and play by the still forest pool. And of course, the meaning of that simile should be clear to you now. The still forest pool is your mind. The animals which come out to play are these nimittas. The ordinary nimittas can come out, but only if you're still. If they know that you're watching, they will run away again. You have to be like the nature photographer, so still that those nimittas don't know you're watching. If you get excited, they'll go away. If you get afraid, they'll go away. If you try and hold on to them, they'll go away. You've got to watch them without interfering at all. Watch them so they don't know you're watching. You have to be that still. If you are that still, just the ordinary nimittas come up, play for a while and disappear. And then the amazing nimittas come up. These incredibly beautiful, powerful lights in the mind. They come up there, and if you don't interfere with them, they will stay to delight you and maybe take you to the next stage of meditation. However, if you get excited or afraid, they all go away. So those of you who have had any nimittas, why do they go away? Because they know you're watching. You've interfered with them. Now this becomes a very subtle part of meditation, to be able to see something absolutely passively, not doing anything at all. This is where the doer is almost completely subdued. The only part of the mind left is the knowing mind. Pure mindfulness without doing anything. If you try and note, that animal will note straight away and that nimitta will go away. If you try and note it, it will not stay. You've just got to leave it alone. Don't say anything. And then the animal stays. Now you can understand the peace which you need. The third part of the nimitta, which is important, is its powers, its beauty. And the power and the beauty of the nimitta, again, you're not seeing this with the eyes, you're seeing it with the mind. And sometimes it's so brilliant, you think you'll go blind. It's just more powerful than 100 suns, 1,000 suns, 1,000,000 suns. Sometimes that's how powerful the light is. And sometimes you think, wow, how can I stand this? It's going to blind, it's going to burn off my retina. But you're not seeing it with the eye, you're seeing it with the mind. It's a pure mental image. This is what should happen with those nimittas. They should be incredibly bright and beautiful. Sometimes people wonder about the colour of those nimittas. It does not matter what colour it is. In fact, and this is quite a powerful insight, all the nimittas are exactly the same. You add the colour. That's actually your perception does that. The nimittas, they're colourless. They're just energy, they're brightness. But you add them. So it doesn't really matter what colour they are. What's most important is the purity of them, the brilliance, the power. Sometimes, some meditators, some years ago, they came up and said, yeah, they got a nimitta, it was quite stable, but it was sort of grey and dirty. They asked me, what's going on? I know exactly what was going on. I said, have you been keeping your precepts? And they get, And this is actually a tremendous part of meditation where you find why precepts are necessary for success in meditation. Up to this stage, you can get to this stage without keeping precepts or without keeping them perfectly or purely. But when you get to this stage, you're coming face to face with your mind, with your citta. And that guy who saw his nimitta just a bit dirty, it was because he wasn't keeping a good lifestyle. He wasn't pure. And he saw that. At this particular stage, you cannot sort of be dishonest because it's right in front of you. If you haven't washed your face and you look in a mirror, you have to see that. It's the same with your nimitta stage. What you see is the purity of your mind. Having known that, if you keep your precepts, if you practice dharma, if you're compassionate and do service, whether it's to old people home or palliative care units, you will find you've got a bright mind. You're pure hearted. And when you get to that stage in meditation, your nimitta, your mind will be so powerful, it'll be incredibly beautiful. It's a fascinating point of Dhamma this. And it's one of the reasons why, maybe not so much here in Malaysia, because I only come every now and again, but in Perth, because that's where I live, and I see many of the disciples every day, and I know their lifestyle. I've known them for many years. I know what type of people they are. I can predict when people meditate, who are going to get those deep meditations the easiest. It's those people who have the pure hearts. Those people who keep on giving to the temple or giving to the society, and they never ask for anything. They keep their precepts, they never argue. They're the first to ask for forgiveness when something happens. They don't really care, they've got just hardly any ego left. You know what I mean by the pure-hearted people? You've seen those people. Those people are just such pure-hearted people. They never say a bad word about anybody. They never gossip. They're just so kind, they're just so caring, just so good, the sort of people you'd love to have around. They've got such beautiful jitsas, beautiful minds. When it first comes up, wow, that's beautiful. So, if you get a nimitta and it's not that beautiful, you know what to do. Look at your precepts, look at your generosity, look at your forgiveness. If you're having arguments with somebody, your nimitta won't be good. There's unfinished business. You've got to forgive, let go. Just be inspired, have this beautiful, compassionate, pure-hearted mind. And the more you see that, the more powerful your mind becomes. And at this stage, when you first see your mind is incredibly beautiful. So you understand now why some monks have an easy time getting into the jhanas. Their mind is so powerful, as soon as it comes up, it's incredibly beautiful and powerful. These are the three things you need. For those of you who haven't got that good animitta, if it comes up, if you're not that pure, you know, you're sort of ordinary, you keep your five precepts, but every now and again, you know, you tell them, they call it white lies, but you find out all lies are black. So that's actually the white lie. But you'll find that you can still do something with your nimitta. This is a little trick that in all the nimittas, even if they're grey, they've always got a beautiful part. So you've got some grey smudges on there, but you've got some clean places as well. Go look for the clean place. Put your attention on the most beautiful part of your nimitta, the brightest, purest part. And straight away, the mind will actually focus in there. And then keep on focusing on the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part. And if you know how to do that, focusing to the most beautiful part, someone who always inclines to the beauty, to the positive, not to the negative, and not to the fault-finding. But then actually you can almost bypass the grey parts of your nimitta and go straight into this beautiful nimitta. That nimitta is your mind. For those of you who want to know what the mind is, that's a jitta you're watching. Face to face with the citta, which is one of the reasons why there's a famous saying by the Buddha. He said the citta is radiant when there's no defilements come onto it. And this is actually what that means. When you get to that stage and the mind is free of defilements because you lived a pure life recently, then your mind is radiant, it's pure, it's wonderful, it's so joyful. And with that pure, beautiful mind is incredible amounts of energy and happiness. And this is actually where it gets tough to be able to hold stillness with that degree of energy and happiness. Sometimes people start shaking and they start crying. They can't get any further. That's all they get from that particular meditation. But my good, that's so powerful. And incredibly blissful. And sometimes, I don't mind saying this, but sometimes, at that stage of meditation, sometimes the thought comes up, my goodness, how much bliss can you take? And I found out the answer to that, you can always take more bliss. There's no limit to the ecstasy which you can feel at that stage of meditation. So that's a nice invitation to bliss out more than any other ecstasy and bliss you've ever experienced in your whole existence. But we don't just do it for the ecstasy and bliss of it, even though that's a sign that the mind is getting powerful. The next thing which happens once you stabilize that nimitta, the five senses have gone by now. Stabilize the nimitta, which is so still, so beautiful, the simple light. First of all, don't worry whether it's a circle or a square or a star. If you focus on the edges of that nimitta, you're focusing on a place inside, outside duality. You're focusing on a place of complexity. Always just focus in the middle. Don't worry what shape it is or how big or how small it is. Just keep in the center. And if you do that, and you keep that thing stable, because you cannot want or do anything here, if you do anything, the whole thing falls apart. Keep it still, keep it stable, don't do anything. Which is why when people say, yeah, I've got to that stage, what do I do next? Stupid, you don't do anything next, you don't do anything even now. You've got there, stay there, rest, allow the whole process to happen. Don't do anything. Stop this doing and managing business. This is all about letting go. What you have to let go of now is you. There's still, what is left is what I call the potential to do. Sure, you're not doing anything, but if you want to, you can still do that. You can still do something. Now you've got to let go of the potential to do and completely vanish. And if you can just have that guts to let go of the potential to do, so all will is turned off, then you'll go into the jhanas. Beautiful, blissful states, which I will talk about tomorrow. But these are the nimittas. One last point about these nimittas. You may recognize the description of a light which appears when the five senses disappear in meditation as very similar to another time a light appears when the five senses die. How many people, and maybe some of you may have had the out-of-the-body experiences, how many people have had those experiences of dying? Or at least know other people who have. And the standard description, no matter what religion you have, is of floating out of your body. It doesn't happen to everybody, but to many. Floating out of your body and then going towards the light. You know what that light is? Exactly the same as you experience at this stage of meditation. Why does that appear when you die? Because when you die, the five senses are suppressed. They get turned off because the physical body is not working anymore. And what's left when you die? The jitta, the mind. So at this particular stage of meditation, you're actually learning exactly what happens when you die. It's like a rehearsal. So, anyone who gets into that nimitta stage, you're practicing how to die. Because that's exactly what will happen. And when you die, that nimitta which you see, if it's bright and beautiful and powerful and pure, then you're going to get a wonderful rebirth, if any rebirth at all. That's where you find all your good karma you've done in the past. If you've done a beautiful good karma in the past, that light you see after you die is beautiful, it's pure, it's so wonderful. Now I'll either send you to a heaven realm, or maybe a jhana realm, or maybe enlighten you. Give you a good chance. But if you've been naughty in this life, if you have some bad karma you haven't resolved, then when you die, that nimitta is going to be dirty, and that's not going to help you much at all. So be careful. This is actually telling you about what happens when you die. Because when you die, the body with its five senses falls apart. The mind is what's left, the jitta. Just like in the meditation, the five senses have stopped, the jitta is left, the mind. And it's beautiful if you have been beautiful. That's why precepts, generosity, compassion, metta is so important. And that's why that sometimes, especially in Western countries, people think you can meditate without keeping your five precepts. You can get so far, but you can't get further. Because your precepts aren't pure enough yet. When the precepts are pure, you meditate in this way, you're getting beautiful jhanas, and then I'll tell you in a couple of days the deep insight how you can become enlightened from that. But this is what happens with the nimittas. When these nimittas come up, because I've explained it to you, you know what happens, please, please, please don't get afraid. Because these wonderful things are happening. This is what's supposed to happen. You get lots of happiness, lots of joy, lots of bliss, lots of power, and people think something must be wrong. And they get afraid. And it's a beautiful thing which is going to happen. But if you do get afraid, know that you're in good company. Because in the suttas, the Buddha said he was afraid of that bliss and power. While the Bodhisattva, he too was afraid. This is so powerful. So beware of that. You don't need to be afraid. It's just perfectly safe. In fact, it's super safe. And it's going to lead into some wonderful things. If you've got any illnesses, great chance of using that power to heal them. If you want to get deeper in insight, huge insights come. Powerful happiness, having a great time. You sit in meditation, you don't feel any pain in the body. 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. And you get up and you're just dancing. There's no pain in the body. So loose and so nice. Oh, this is good. This is what happens. So don't be afraid. Number two, don't be excited. Oh, it's happening, it's happening. Oh, because if you get excited, it all falls apart again. Don't do anything. Don't think, it's happening, I've got to take some notes. Because that spoils it as well. The absolute, so you'll be able to remember everything which happened afterwards. Don't take any notes, don't interfere, be absolutely still. Imagine you're like Ajahn Chah, just watching by the still forest pool, watching these amazing beings just come out and play. And then actually you know just why, even at this stage, why monks love meditating and all the happiness and joy which they get out of it. Just this much, this is so wonderful, so profound. And these are experiences, not theories. And if you want to know what the mind is, there it's right in front of you. You can check afterwards, you can't hear anything. Sometimes you meditate and there's a storm outside, you can't hear the lightning. Sometimes it's happened that people pick you up, like that fellow I was told you about last night, who was taken to the hospital. He didn't know he was being picked up and put in the ambulance. You can't feel a thing. Mosquitoes bite you, you can't feel anything. And someone comes up to you and says, it's lunchtime, you can't hear them. You don't care either. You're having such wonderful fun. You don't need any lunch. So these are beautiful states of mind, the nimittas. Sometimes people get these things naturally. They just, some days they just let go so much for one reason or another. Make these beautiful lights in the mind. They call them spiritual experiences. They want to find out what's happening. And when he actually explained it this way, that's what happened. Yeah. When the five senses are shut down, this is what happens. The mind shines. So the job of meditation, one good way of calling this job of meditation is to let go of the five senses. To the point that you're not worried about what you hear, what you feel in the body, not worried about sights, smells, tastes. The whole five senses just disappears. Calm down. When they all disappear, that's when you can know what your mind is. That's where you get all the insights into the nature of the mind. So there we go. Nimittas. What they are. How to get them. And how to enjoy them. So, any questions about what we've said so far? Any questions about the nimittas? Yes, thank you. Short? Short spread. You can get them. Okay. Oh, a couple of hours. Yeah, can last a long time. Sometimes, no, usually days you get into the jhanas if it stays, go to the next stage. But what actually happens is, by this time, if you get like a nimitta, you don't have no perception of time anymore. So when a person gets into the nimitta stage, they haven't got a clue that time is passing. Because when you're in the present moment, completely in the present moment, the whole perception of the flow of time is taken away from you. You come to like a I call it the timeless present. And 1 hour, 10 minutes, 10 hours feels exactly the same. Which is why, you know, sometimes that happens when people are meditating, even before the stage of nimittas. They don't know it's been 2 hours or 10 minutes. And they've been perfectly alert all the time. Perfectly, they haven't been sleeping, perfectly aware, very energized. But the perception of time has disappeared. And that's why, until you're free of time. You know what it's like to wait for a bus or wait for somebody to come? And that's just torture. Instead of actually waiting, we're just here. And just time comes, but we're always just standing still. And then that stillness doesn't really matter how much time. But because of that stillness, that's why it can last a long time. But usually, a nimitta, I can't see it lasting more than a few hours. Usually it would actually go deeper into the jhana if you're that stable. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's usually people end up in a psychiatric ward either if they have got schizophrenia to begin with. So these are the people who have already hear sounds or see sights, just even in normal life, they haven't even started meditating yet. And such people are prone to schizophrenia, but if they come to a meditation retreat, you've got to be very careful. If they take their medication, there's no problem at all. But there's one of the problems with schizophrenia, it always tends to go with a paranoia as well. As if they think they don't need these medications, and the government or the CIA is making them take this medication to suppress something or other. And it's that paranoia which actually stops them taking the medication, which in a retreat sometimes they just don't take it and they go a bit crazy. It's only those people. And actually you can usually tell that they had a problem before. If a person is just the ordinary average person, like, you know, all the people here, then what happens is that, you know, you get into those limiters and you may sort of hear those voices and stuff, but they won't change you crazy. It's just, especially when you've got good instructions, you know, these are just things of the mind, don't believe in them, they're just a little bit to play about. You don't believe those no more than you believe E.T. on the movie. It's just a movie, that's all. You can enjoy it without getting involved in it. So I've never had any casualties from my retreats yet. Not one. So I think you're quite safe. There's also the other time when people sometimes get into psychiatric problems is when they try too hard. When they really force their meditation, when they're striving and they're struggling. Because the mind is a very sensitive thing. If they use too much force, sometimes that they break things in the mind, they bend it, they twist it, and it takes a long time to heal that wound. So it's also just the way I've taught meditation here. It's a soft, a gentle meditation. If you feel tired, go and take a rest. Don't try so hard. Let go. Be at peace. Be kind. Be calm. If you've got a crazy mind, let it be crazy. Stop fighting it. It's the fighters, the ones who usually get wounded. And those are the ones that sometimes go to the hospitals. Because they've been fighting too hard. No wonder they got wounded. They're just fighting themselves. Just let go. For those of you who do have a crazy mind, who go seeking too much and you can't make it still, I've got another teaching. It's called the Nalagiri Strategy. This is how to deal with a crazy mind. I think many of you who've been to the Dharma school when you were children know the story of Nalagiri. He was the crazy elephant. The Buddha had an enemy. It doesn't matter if you're a Buddha, we all have our enemies. No matter who you are, there'll always be someone who doesn't like you. That's nature. So, now one of the Buddha's enemies decided to kill the Buddha. And so that he knew the Buddha was coming on arms round down a narrow street in the city. So he intoxicated this elephant and let the elephant loose as the Buddha was coming in the opposite direction. And this huge crazy elephant was charging down the street. And all the people were running away and running into houses, climbing up trees. When they saw the Buddha and the monks come, they say, "Get out of the way, there's a crazy elephant coming this direction." And all the monks, they climbed up trees as well and went in houses, except for Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, who just loved the Buddha so much, he stood in front of the Buddha, said, "Let the elephant take me, I will protect you." He was going to sacrifice his life for the Buddha. It was really sweet, but very stupid. And the Buddha said, "Ananda," he pushed him aside, "Look, I can look after this. You climb up some tree somewhere." Or something like that. And so there the Buddha faced this crazy elephant by himself. If you've ever seen an elephant charging, they're crazy, they're mad, they've got such huge momentum, they trample you. What do you think the Buddha did? The Buddha has incredible powers. If the Buddha wanted to, he could have actually grabbed this elephant by the trunk, twirled him three times around his head, and thrown him on the other side of the Ganges. The power of a Buddha is that strong. He could have used force and easily defeated the crazy elephant. But did the Buddha do that? No, he is metta, loving kindness. As that elephant came to him, he would have said something like, Nalagiri, the door of my heart's open to you no matter what you do. You can trample me if you wish. You can pick me up and slam me on the ground. You can break every bone in my body. Nalagiri, I give you unconditional loving kindness. Whatever you do to me, that's fine. When you give that powerful loving kindness to anything like a raging elephant, there's only one possible outcome. Anger cannot last with such forgiveness, with such kindness. In a few seconds, Nalagiri's anger, his craziness, had completely vanished. He was bowing there in front of the Buddha, with the Buddha just stroking his trunk. There, there, Nalagiri. It's all right. There, there. Nice, Nalagiri. Now that's actually the power of loving kindness. That's what it can do. So I call this the Nalagiri strategy. If you've got a crazy mind, like an intoxicated elephant, about to trample all over you, what do? Stop fighting it. Stop saying, I'm not going to be crazy, I'm not going to think, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. Stop using your willpower and use your loving kindness power instead. My crazy mind, if you want to be crazy, that's fine. Doesn't matter if you want to think just crazy thoughts, if you want to think for the rest of this week, if you want to go to sleep and think all night, crazy mind, the door of my heart's open to you. You can be crazy. I give you absolute full permission to be crazy. And if you give that degree of loving kindness to your crazy mind, within a few seconds, your crazy mind will be bowing in front of you, and you're just stroking it. There, mind. It's all right, mind. Shh. It's okay. You were crazy, but it's okay. Shh. You'll be absolutely at peace. I call that the Nalagiri strategy. If you've got a crazy mind, don't fight it. Give it loving kindness. Complete acceptance. You've got to do 100% now. Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly. The similes and differences between praying and meditation. There are some types of prayer which is called asking for things, which where you pray, you know, may God make me rich, may Jesus tell me the lottery, may sort of the Buddha give me a nice wife. Not the one I've got, but a much better one, please. Whatever it is, you're asking for something. So a lot of like praying is that in Christianity and Buddhism as well. You see people coming with their incense sticks and praying for good luck in the lottery, or they get incense sticks praying that the business deal is going to go through, asking Ajahn Brahm, can you please do some chanting so that my son will pass his degree. That actually happened some time ago in Perth. I think she was a Malaysian girl. Yes, there we go. She was studying in Perth. It's about time for her to do her examinations. So the day before her examination, she came, it wasn't actually to me, it was to one of the other monks in my monastery, can you do some chanting for me? I got an exam tomorrow. So this monk was so kind, and he thought, give her some encouragement. So he did some chanting for her. And we heard from her friend, she never came back to the temple again, we heard from her friend, she was going around saying, the monks in my monastery are no good. Because she failed. She never passed. And she blamed our chanting. And when I asked about it, the reason why she failed, she'd never gone to any lectures. She was just having parties all the time. And just having fun. When it came to examination, she hoped the monks would sort out that part of her academic life. But of course, chanting, it can encourage you. It can give you a bit of confidence. But most of the passing examinations is what you do. So some of the praying is just a waste of time. If you're on the edge and a bit of confidence and encouragement, yeah, it can actually work. But it's usually just tips the balance. But it can't do much more than that. So if someone hasn't been doing any studies, then asking the monks to do the praying, it won't work. So, There's that praying, which is actually asking for something. For meditation, we don't ask for anything. It's all about letting go, creating this incredible peace and power of the mind. But there is another type of Christian prayer, which again is not asking for anything. It's just trying to be at peace, trying to be still. And that is quite similar. But that's actually quite rare. Most of the Christians actually ask for things. And the same as many of the old Buddhists ask for things as well, which is again, it's a waste of time. Does that make sense? See? Does that answer your question? Yeah. There is an old type of prayer, because those, especially the Christian and Buddhist traditions, they had much more in common in the early times than many people give credence for. Now, Buddhism did influence, especially monastic Christianity. As anyone who knows history, there's no reason why you should have monasticism in Christianity. And it's only because that at that time that Buddhism was actually strong. It did have its monasteries in Alexandria. And somebody was actually saying there's even monasteries in Arabia, Saudi Arabia and Palestine at that time. They're sent out by the Buddhists in India. It was going along the Silk Route and it colonized many places. So there were thriving monasteries. There certainly was a thriving Buddhist monastery in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. So there was a lot of influence of Buddhism. And that monastic influence of Buddhism continued on in southern Egypt, which was the old desert fathers. And that certainly came from Buddhism. There was no other tradition which had monasticism at all. And any Christian would say there's no reason why they should have started monasteries just on Jesus' teachings in the Bible. They had to have some other source. And the obvious source was Buddhism. And so with that monasticism, more so many of the practices as well, such as meditation, were also infiltrated. Make sense? Okay. Yes. Now, is this one over here first? 1, 2, 3, yeah. Yeah. Nature's call, okay, yeah. It does subdue even nature's calls as well. So even it may have a full bladder. You don't feel it at all. And because it's incredibly healthy, because the body is just so relaxed and so still, if you go to the toilet afterwards, you don't have any sort of physical problems as a result. Now, because sometimes you hold your bladder too long, now that could sort of create some inflammation somewhere. But when you're meditating, everything relaxes so much that the bladder just keeps the water in there. It doesn't secrete more because the metabolism has gone down. So it doesn't increase the pressure. And you're fine afterwards. No problem at all. So even nature's calls, everything just relaxes and everything is fine. So when you get to that limited stage, it's one of the most healthiest of things you can do. Yes, you had a question over here? At what point do you switch from watching the breath to watching the nimitta? You don't switch at all. It happens naturally. It's like, at what point do you pass, you know, from Malaysia into Thailand if you're going north to Bangkok? It's like a gradual process. You just keep on going. When it comes to the right time and the right place, it happens without you deciding. So your job is just to keep on watching the breath and doing nothing. Just watch the breath, be in the moment. Don't try and drive the process forward. Don't hold it back. Just allow the mind to choose. Sometimes to get people some understanding, I said it's like you're in a car, you're driving along, and now you give your keys to the mind, not to you, and you get out the driving seat and let the mind take over. You just become the passenger. You don't give any orders at all. You just watch the breath, The breath becomes just so still and so beautiful. Then the nimittas come up when they want to come up. And if they're not ready, quite naturally they will disappear and you'll just go back to the breath. If you don't interfere with the process, it's completely natural, it's so easy. If the nimittas are the right time, they just stay. And they develop when you're ready. So you just, you know, leave it alone. You're just watching on the journey. You're not doing any choice. Just keep watching whatever's in front of your mind. Don't choose what you're watching. No thinking, no choice. No doing, no managing. No interfering. Leave it alone. It's all happening. Just like, you know what it is sometimes. I remember when I was a kid, you watch the movies. And in the movie, sometimes the bad guy was creeping up on the good guy. And it was on a movie, but some guy in the cinema would say, "Hey, look out, he's coming behind you, behind you." Even if it's a movie, they still have to interfere. So they can't even leave a movie alone. And this is sometimes what we do. "Hey, the nimittas coming, watch it, come on." Don't be like someone in the stalls of a movie theatre shouting out at the movie. Leave it alone, you just watch. Yes, in the back. Nimitta is a mind-made sign. It is a mind-made sign, but it's caused by a lot of letting go. It's not mind-made, it is the mind. Another what? Another power? Imagination. Okay, it's not imagination because it's actually real. You try to imagine something like that, you can't do it. Especially the first time these things come up. They're so powerful, you've never seen anything like that before. Your imagination is completely confined to your past experiences. You can only imagine old things. To actually create is just too difficult. So when these images first come, you know it's not imagination. There's no way you can imagine anything as beautiful and powerful as that. This is completely new. Completely sort of unexpected. That's why you know this is not imagination. Can't do anything like that. It's too powerful. And it always has to come up when the five senses are gone. If you try and imagine, you can't hear anything. Can you do it? You always hear something. You can't imagine yourself out of feeling your body. Imagination's not powerful enough to do things like that. So this is all part of the process of the mind becoming still and going into incredible, wonderful places. Places where few people go. There's no reason why. You know, some of you have already got nimittas, and it's not that hard to get if you follow the instructions. And it can give you incredible power and beauty. You just go on a 9-day retreat, many people get the nimittas. Wow, it's just so wonderful, so beautiful, so lovely. And you find this meditation business is so much fun. And it also has these other incredible side effects, like deep wisdom, full seeing, you get so happy. It's a great thing to do. And these are your real experiences, not imaginations. And you've got something really spiritual. I remember teaching Buddhism in Western countries. Sometimes they say, "Well, yeah, Buddhism another theory, just another dogma. The Buddha said this, the Christians say something else, the Muslims say something else, the Hindus say something else. How do we know what's true?" And people want experience, something which really moves them. Something like powerful inner experience which actually shows them what the truth is. So this meditation actually shows you just how powerful this Buddhism is. It's a real experience. It's not some thing you learn from a monk or you read in a book. This is your own real powerful experiences. As I say, in a couple of days' time, how you can use that power to remember your past lives. So this reincarnation business, you can find out for yourself. You don't have to worry about believing it, whether it's right or wrong, whether the Christians say it is or the Buddhists say it isn't or whatever. You can find out for yourself. That's what insight means. It settles the questions. So you know. You don't have to believe anymore. So you get these powerful mind experiences like in Nimittas. You can understand why, what sort of mind you need to get enlightened. And why a lot of people, they never actually find the truth, because they never train their mind to be strong enough first. When you get that strength of mind, then you know how enlightenment happens. You can feel its power. You can feel its force. The force is with you. I got all these young monks in my monastery, 2021, and they're all telling me they were just so sad, so upset, that they ordained as monks too soon. They should have waited one more year so they could see the last episode of Star Wars. And we missed it, we became a monk too soon. Because as a monk you can't watch movies. So they've been telling me all about Star Wars. Apparently they showed me a book, someone's written The Dharma and Star Wars or something. Or Star Wars and the Dharma. It's about all about Buddhist ideas which are apparently enclosed in Star Wars. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's, they're all into it in my monastery at the moment. So may the force be with you. Are there any other questions before we finish off tonight? Yes? Are there some yogis that never see the Nimittas? Of course there are. And sometimes they're not encouraged actually to go that deep. But a lot of people, whether encouraged or not encouraged, sometimes they see those Nimittas anyway. It's just nature. Because when you're meditating, you're doing some letting go. No matter what type of meditation you're doing, there's always some letting go. And sometimes you get just so peaceful and so still. These things just come up. And the reason why I teach like this is so you know what's going on, you know what's happening when they do go up, come up. And sometimes people, they haven't heard these teachings about Nimittas, and so they're so thankful. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm, now I understand what happened. They're meditating on their own and without any instructions, a Hindu meditation or whatever. These things happen, they say, that makes sense, that's what's happening. Five senses, and the mind comes up. This is beautiful light. Lots of happiness in this. It's exactly the same Nimittas. All Nimittas are the same. Because it's just a reflection of your mind. So you can use Kasina meditation. But I have to tell people very carefully, Kasina meditation is very different than casino meditation. They may sound the same, but you don't get any Nimittas by going to the casino. Kasina meditation is where you focus on a disc. And you use that. This is actually interesting. Instead of using feeling, using sight as your last of the five senses. Remember I said the reason why most people do the breath is because instead of giving away the five senses completely, they just take part of the feeling sense, the feeling of the breath, and then from that the five senses disappear. Doing limited, you're taking physical sight, especially the image in your mind from that sight as a way of letting go of all the five senses. So you go through sight rather than through feeling to abandon all the five senses. But when the five senses are all abandoned, you see the mind. That's how you do it with Nimittas, with Kasinas. Exactly the same path. Yes, one last question and then we finish with that. Yeah? How many percent get Nimittas? On every retreat, well, I don't know, I've never done a statistical analysis, but just the number which comes up in my mind, I've got to think about this, 30%, 40%? A lot of people get Nimittas, about 30-40% people get Nimittas. But there's all sorts of different, maybe even more than that. Sometimes people get flashing limiters, they don't last very long. It's not that hard to do, because people meditate for a whole 9 days, and maybe more than that. For a whole 9 days, there's bound to come one day when you're really on top of your meditation, when everything feels nice, you're going really well, and it happens. So maybe I should up that, about half of people or something. I don't know, I've never done the analysis, because I don't really worry about such things. And if you don't get it the first time, you do it the next time, you've got more chance to get it the next time. The next time, the next time. Maybe more than, I think. I know, it's very hard to say. Does that sort of answer your question? Yeah, if you do rituals before, I don't think it will really make any difference. It's also the sometimes the rituals like fasting can sometimes be too extreme. And sometimes you have extreme rituals like fasting or fire walking and stuff like that. Sometimes a lot of people can do that, but sometimes people can't. And if, you know, at least in this meditation, there's no sort of danger at all. This is so safe. And everybody gets something out of it. You don't have to be physically fit to be able to fast. So I don't know if any rituals are needed. There's enough success rate. When I say 30%, it means if you do 3 retreats, then you get 90% success. So eventually you get there. You get lots of people getting limiters, but maybe just on one retreat. First retreat, you know, maybe 30% on the first retreat. Maybe you go 50%, 60% on your second, 80% on the third, or whatever. I don't know. Roughly about that. It really depends on just, you know, how much they follow the instructions. Okay. So I think that's enough for tonight. It's 9:30, so we can do the sharing of merits with everybody, with all sentient beings.
Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita Om Tuyatayo Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu.
I love those types of sea sadhus. Next one is always more joyful than the one before. Okay, so tomorrow night is jhanas, isn't it? On the list. It gets even more deeper and more profound. So tomorrow night's talk, the jhanas.